Well, hello, potential book-buying public, or actual book-buying person. This is Chuck Klosterman. I am, I guess, recording a portion of my book, Killing Yourself to Live, in order to give you an idea of what it's like. And I'm hoping you will listen to this, and then you will like it, I guess, and decide that you should make sure other people buy it. With this book, like I said, this book is called Killing Yourself to Live, and it's the subtitle is 85% of a True Story. And it's sort of this book based on a piece I'd done for Spin Magazine, where I had essentially driven across the entire country in a rental car, visiting the locations of famous rock deaths, like where the Leonard Skinner plane crash happened, and like where Kurt Cobain killed himself, and where one of the Replacements died, and where Buddy Holly died, and where, you know, where Jeff Buckley died. And along the way, I was basically involved with these three relationships with women, one being a woman who in the book is named Diane, who I was working with at Spin, one being a woman named Lenore, who I had been involved with for probably 5 years earlier in my life, and then a third woman named Quincy, who I had been involved with long, long ago, but still sort of occupied a certain place in my mind. I kind of I'm thinking about these three women and these three relationships as I'm going to all these places where people have died. So essentially, the book is about kind of being obsessed with death and being obsessed with being in love. And it kind of seems to kind of take the idea of dying and loving and kind of jamming them together into one emotion. So the part I'm going to read is actually something that happens in the city of Minneapolis, where I was for one evening. There are elements of this book where the woman I had mentioned, Quincy, she lives in Minneapolis, and I'm trying to get a hold of her, but for whatever reason, I can't, even though we had planned to kind of hook up when I was there. And the woman, Lenore, who I mentioned, I'm actually seeing her the next night after the scenario I'm about to describe. So, like, I'm trying to see this person named Quincy, I'm going to see this person named Lenore, and I'm visiting a friend of mine and staying in his apartment. And this is sort of what happened that night. The day is warm, but the day is disappearing. I've just arrived at the apartment of my nemesis. I am sitting beneath a mammoth poster of the film Blow Up, and my nemesis is sitting in front of a computer that looks like two computers. Stay away from my window. We're drinking beer and talking about mutual friends we've completely lost contact with. Something is going to happen tonight. Disconnect the telephone. I met my nemesis in November of 1990. I walked into somebody's dorm room to play Nintendo, and he was sitting on the bed, holding an acoustic guitar that he could only play one note on. The opening note of Tesla's Love Song. He was wearing a denim jacket, and he had used a magic marker to draw the symbol for anarchy on the back. It was just about the silliest thing I had ever seen. We immediately became friends. One night, we were driving down Demers Avenue in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and I was sitting in the passenger seat of his Buick Skylark. I made a joke about the likelihood of my nemesis having anal sex with his high school girlfriend, which is a reference I made 30 or 40 times a day. He pulled over the car and hit me in the face. Soon after, we decided to live together. Every interaction we had was based on arguing, drinking, or both. Usually both. For the first 2 years we knew each other, it was the most creative friendship I had ever experienced. Over the next 2 years, it became the most self-destructive, unhealthily competitive relationship I would ever have with anyone. Though we remained close friends for 4 years, I'm fairly certain we hated each other. At the conclusion of those 4 years, I graduated from college and immediately got a great job at the largest daily newspaper in North Dakota's largest city. Now, this actually means I got a normal job at a tiny newspaper in a small American town. But it seemed like a big deal at the time, because I was writing a high-profile column for this publication, and I suddenly became a mini-celebrity in downtown Fargo, which is kind of like being the hottest guy in the Traveling Wilburys. Well, it's all right, riding around in the breeze. Well, it's all right. This seemed to annoy my nemesis. Around the same time, a few unsuccessful goofballs I knew from college started an alternative newspaper, and my nemesis, who was probably my closest friend at the time, used this completely irrelevant alternative publication as a vehicle to publicly attack me. I responded poorly to this. It prompted me to drive back to Grand Forks, drink about 27 beers, and punch him in the face in front of all our friends. My nemesis seemed to oddly accept my drunken haymaker, and I suspect he felt like he kind of deserved to get punched at least once. Sadly, I was under the impression that hitting him in the face once would not be as effective as hitting him in the face, say, 1,000 times. And more unfortunately, my nemesis had consumed somewhere in the vicinity of 0 beers, and he had spent his formative years fighting all the people from his hometown who didn't like his anarchy jacket. And most unfortunately, this was the only fight I'd ever been in. Consequently, my career fighting record remains 0-1-0. Afterwards, we stood on opposite sides of the street and yelled at each other for so long that the partygoers who happened to witness the debacle actually got bored. They slowly filtered back inside the house to listen to the new Pavement album. I assumed my nemesis and I would never speak again, and for 3 years, we didn't. But then I ran into him in a bar, and we both wanted to pretend we were cooler than Steve McQueen, so we spoke casually, almost as if we had just seen each other 2 days ago. Slowly, we started communicating again, usually via email. He's an interesting character, and he's very smart and charismatic, and I suppose I love him. And it's weird, because now we never fight. We don't fully trust each other, we aren't emotionally close, and I suspect he would secretly feel like he won if I became a failure and my career completely collapsed. But I'm still staying at his apartment tonight, because he is my nemesis. And your nemesis can't be your nemesis unless he is also your friend. My nemesis asked me a few questions about why I am driving across America, but he is only mildly interested in my answers. He has a job that involves the internet, and it sounds difficult and boring. I ask him questions too, but barely listen to his answers. He's had this job for at least 5 years, and I still have no idea what he does. After 4 drinks, we drive to some hipster Minneapolis restaurant for dinner, and we talk about the strengths and weaknesses of our respective cell phones. Our larger plan is to meet 3 other people at a poofy college bar called the Kitty Cat Club. We get there before 9 o'clock. The first of these 3 people to arrive is a local rock critic, and he likes to drink. He's drinking guy. The second of these 3 people is another local rock critic, but he only orders Coca-Cola. He's non-drinking guy. The third person is yet another local rock critic, and she has an astounding skeletal structure. She looks like Uma Thurman. I think we talk for maybe 33 seconds before I become obsessed with engineering a scenario that will result in me kissing her. So now I am in a bar with three rock critics, one of whom I want to kiss, and my nemesis, a guy who probably should have become a rock critic. I have traveled 2,000 miles to do precisely what I do four nights a week in Manhattan. The beginning is the end is the beginning. I go outside the bar and attempt to contact Quincy for the sixth time, and she still doesn't answer my cell phone call. For the sixth time, I leave no message. Fuck. I guess she doesn't want to see me. My posse of rock critics, meanwhile, has moved to the bar's patio, so I join them for some Midwestern power drinking. There are a lot of drunks in this world, but people in the Midwest drink differently than everywhere else I've ever been. It's far less recreational. You have to stay focused, you have to work fast, and you have to swallow as much as possible. Uma, Drinking Guy, my nemesis, and myself are all like pirates. I can't believe Non-Drinking Guy is comfortable with this, but he seems cool with our self-destruction. This impresses me because personally, I despise being around drunk people whenever I'm sober. We all kind of talk like we're doing impersonations of Camille Paglia, assuming she had just snorted a lot of Ritalin. Liz Phair has just released a much maligned comeback album, and it seems like we analyzed this record for 2 fucking hours. Or maybe 10 fucking minutes. Uma Thurman keeps giving me cigarettes that I'm not even asking for. Every cigarette makes me excited. Something is going to happen tonight. Now, here's the rub. Going into this evening, my nemesis had given me the impression that he and Uma Thurman were potentially a romantic item. He never directly said that, but it was implied, or at least that's what I chose to infer. But now that we're drinking, it is obvious that this is not the case. My nemesis merely wants them to be an item. The reason I can tell they're not dating is because he's being really, really, really nice to her. So suddenly I feel way cool. My nemesis and I used to be strikingly similar personalities, but now we're not. Now, he's just a guy she knows in Minneapolis, and I'm somebody else from someplace different who won't be here tomorrow. Uma Thurman is giving me a lot of attention. Her insights about Outkast and Neil Young are trenchant. She is laughing at my jokes, even when they are not funny. Her laughter is irritating my nemesis, and I am a little ecstatic. You see, my nemesis also knows Lenore. They met at a party a few years ago. Since that meeting, my nemesis has unsuccessfully tried to kiss Lenore on no less than 3 separate occasions. He doesn't know that I know this, but I know this. And I would like to say that this is not on my mind, but it kind of is. In Minneapolis, the bars close early. We decide to go back to my nemesis's apartment to drink more booze and get high and continue arguing about whether or not Boston had 2 great songs or no great songs. The jury remains split on this issue. Drinking Guy wants to go to his home and sleep, but it's not difficult to change Drinking Guy's mind. I ride my nemesis's Ford Mustang, and I'm shocked by how well he drives when he's dangerously intoxicated. That's another skill set I've lost since moving to New York. For 5 minutes, Uma Thurman drunkenly but purposefully paces the apartment. She's like this long, sexy snow leopard, hunting for vodka and ice cubes and possibly a lighter. It is shocking how fast physical attraction makes you forget everything else in your life. My despair over not connecting with Quincy and my apprehension about the fact that I will be seeing Lenore in less than 24 hours evaporates like boiled milk. Everything Uma says sounds flirtatious, even when she asks me where the bathroom is and I don't know. I'm trying to remember anything I've ever casually said to a woman that made her like me, and I'm saying them all at once. This is going to be complicated, but I have a legitimate shot here. I can see a window of opportunity. But then Uma Thurman does something I could not anticipate. She literally sees a window of opportunity and climbs out onto the roof. Something is going to happen tonight. My nemesis has a palatial apartment, The building was once owned by the heir to the Pillsbury Dough fortune. If you crawl out a certain window, you land on the roof of a smaller apartment building that's directly next to it. From there, you can jump back onto my nemesis's building and ascend to the summit of its roof. But this maneuver is not safe. I suppose it's never safe to climb on any roof, but this roof is very steep and very, very high. So is Uma. She's also been drinking heavily for 4 hours, and she's wearing heels. At this point, it becomes abundantly obvious that my nemesis is pursuing Uma Thurman, because he literally pursues her onto this roof. My nemesis has always been something of an agile goat. This turn of events makes non-drinking guy extremely angry, as he is certain Uma Thurman is going to fall to her death. It is times like these when being non-drinking guy must profoundly suck. Meanwhile, me and drinking guy are trying to ascertain the relative danger of this situation, but now we're too stoned. We can't tell if this behavior is incredibly grave or incredibly normal. That's the single biggest problem with taking drugs. What's normal seems crazy, and what's crazy seems normal. "Do you think we should call the police?" asks drinking guy. "Oh, I don't think so," I say. "Unless you think we should, because if we should do so immediately." "I don't think we should call the police," drinking guy replies. "Although it is going to be pretty bad if she falls off, as she will likely be killed on impact." "Maybe she does this all the time," I say. "She seems pretty good at climbing." "Oh, she's always been good at climbing." "Oh, excellent," I say. "So this is normal. You've obviously seen her climb things before." "Yeah, but I think it might have been a stepladder." Non-drinking guy is now officially enraged with concern. He starts yelling at Uma Thurman, demanding that she come down post-haste, insisting that he is going to leave the scene if she does not, because he is not in the mood to watch her die. Uma is straddling the peak of the roof. "Damn, she looks so hot up there," kicking her head back in laughter, drunkenly risking death for no apparent reason. It's like watching Grace Kelly climb Raymond Burr's fire escape in Rear Window. Non-drinking guy is so pissed that he's actually balling up his fists in rage. "She is going to kill herself," he pleads to me and drinking guy. "Don't you guys care that she will die if she falls off? She will not get hurt. She will be fucking dead." I start to imagine what it would be like if Uma Thurman fell to Earth. Would she plummet in the blink of an eye? Or would it feel like slow motion? Would watching her death haunt me forever? Would I still leave Minneapolis tomorrow morning, no differently than if we had never met? Would I have to include this episode in my narrative since I'm already doing a story about death? Would this night become the most interesting anecdote of my entire life? Would I spend the next 40 years recounting the night I met this foxy rock chick, smoked a few of her cigarettes, spent 4 hours trying to kiss her, and then watched her plummet 60 feet to the pavement? Would the final image of her smashed, bloody face completely erase the image of her perfect cheekbones that currently inhabits my consciousness? Would her death become the only thing I remember about this person? Then Uma climbs down. Uma climbs down from the roof, and so does my nemesis, and then everybody goes into the living room for 2 more beers. Non-drinking guy immediately returns to his traditionally affable self. We start asking each other hypothetical questions, and suddenly it's 4:30 a.m. Uma Thurman hugs me goodbye, and we agree to become friendsters. People don't die. People go home, and people go to bed, and Quincy never leaves me a voicemail. Nothing is going to happen tonight.